The Naples of England by Andy Christopher Miller. Chapter 5. Every Sparrow Fallen. Lizards, snakes, frogs and newts. We were custodians of the hedgerows, the waterlogged bombsite and the waste ground. Inside the old air raid shelter, erratic movements up the wall. In the dark, among the rubble underfoot, something slithering resentfully away. Turning over large rocks or abandoned sheets of galvanised roofing panel, millipedes, spiders or slowworms writhing and dissipating in all directions into the surrounding grass. If we were really lucky, a lordly grass snake or evil-eyed adder. For me, an implicit and approximate understanding of the evolutionary ladder was also my yardstick for empathy. Mollusks, insects, things without legs, if they did not cause me fear, elicited contempt. One of my earliest memories was of playing in a friend's garden and setting out to rid his parents of the pestilence of cabbage-white caterpillars. We enlisted the help of other kids, picking them from the stems and undersides of wrinkled brassica leaves, while I climbed onto their garden shed, a brick-built construction with a rounded metal roof and a chimney. I bent to receive each offering from the others with cupped hands and then, for some reason, dropped them down the chimney. After every half a dozen or so such manoeuvres, I also dropped a rock or broken house brick after them with a grandiose sense of adult importance. I found this complicated method of dispatch thrilling, my sense of dispassionate and mechanised efficiency grossly alluring. Ants, by contrast, were a far more advanced and civilised species than caterpillars. Spectacular, though the cycle of cocoon, dry chrysalis and eventual flowering emergence as a butterfly always proved to be. Colonies of ants lived under the path in our back garden and I was intrigued by their intricate collaborations. They dragged objects in convoy and patiently reorganised, without a visible language or method of signalling, to surmount the various obstacles with which I sought to test their invisible ingenuity. Occasionally, though, I showered them with cascades of boiling water. They were a pest, and I willed myself insensitive to their imagined screaming and gloated in the adult conversations I had with myself. Thinking about it, not getting the job done, being cruel to be kind. At one moment, entranced with being omnipotent and alive, later, shamed, disgusted and frightened by the delight and the delusion of necessity with which I had carried out such unpitying destruction. Set against this, though, I was capable of being deeply distressed by the suffering of animals and birds. At 9 years old, I carried a badly wounded house sparrow in a shoebox on two buses, one to the seafront, then another along Dorchester Road, to secure its relief from a vet. I returned empty-handed, biting back tears, wondering whether the bird really could be saved by the gentle professionalism of the staff. They always die, was the view I'd heard often enough, but also reliving time and again their warm and reassuring attention towards me. Separated from adults, we children shared a different sentient world with creatures of the wild. We patrolled the hawthorn, bramble and sedge. Rare sightings were rumoured, the secret locations of nests traded. We depleted the clusters of warmed and speckled eggs responsibly. Just one for a collection, secure in nature's effortless abundance and its unending replenishment. But to be included, or at least to wander the estate and fields free from ambush and attack, required the suppression of some sensibilities. The older kids, with air rifles, could serve as protectors or as patrolling vigilantes. I became craven, wretched in muted collusion, behind Victor Critchley's hedge one night, as his older brother lined up his sights with the ridge along their rooftop. Like a pack of hunters, finely attuned to each other's silences, we watched the line of sparrows and starlings squabbling and chattering along the tiles. An instant space in the line as the other bird shrieked into the air. Not the zing of spinning tin as at the fair, rustlers with sly grins in neckerchiefs or Indians with tomahawks. Just a puff of feathered life, no more. The slick reloading routine, the muttered acknowledgement of the shot among the older kids. Greater horrors were related, though thankfully never witnessed. The boy, a friendless, spiteful character, plucking out the eyes of live baby birds from the nests, like picking winkles to eat from their shells with a pin, but cruel, merciless, and cold. After I'd been told this, the image would sometimes resurface as I tried to get to sleep at night. I believe that if I never solidified these awful images with my own spoken words, then their intrusions would eventually cease. But although unvoiced, they still returned, and some nights I had to press my own eyeballs in hard with my knuckles to suppress the thoughts and hold myself intact. When I was 9, my Aunt Jocelyn came to stay with us for a few days. On other occasions, Uncle Sid came by himself because they were unable to both leave behind their dog on its own. My aunt's visits were anticipated by my parents with a dizzyingly high degree of anxiety. My father seemed to increase the amount of overtime he worked when she visited, and I was aware of the snatched conversations between my mother and her, worrying away in corners, fast, hushed and watchful, biting back into silence if I approached. On this occasion, Aunt Jocelyn asked if she could bring the dog with her. She warned us that it could get a bit overexcited, but I saw this as no impediment. The vagaries of animal nature were a daily wonder to me, and the search for authoritative but reassuring responses one of life's more welcome challenges. I assured my parents that I would be privileged to take on the major responsibility for the animal's welfare and amusement if it was allowed to come. Whether or not this was a deciding factor, I never learned, but the visit took place, aunt and dog together, and on the second night of their stay, I was granted a wish greater than I could have hoped for. My aunt and mother had tickets for a show on the pier and had to be out of the house half an hour before my father returned home from work. I assured them that my brother and the dog would be safe in my charge, and my mother insisted I locked the door immediately they left and opened it to nobody until my father arrived. As they stepped out and closed the door behind them, I shivered with pride and a giddy sense of autonomy. But before the door could click close behind them, before I could shoot the bolts, the dog ran at it, and then along the hall to the front without stopping. It hit each door with a full force thud, scrambled back to its sliding feet, claws flailing against the lino, and wailed dementedly. It barked sharply, then careered straight into me, unreachable by command or consolation. As I struggled to my feet to follow, it was upstairs in 3 bounds, skidding at speed through the landing, bouncing in flight momentarily like a trampolinist garnering momentum, and then on, sailing out through the open window into the warm evening air of Purbeck Road, a howling, convulsing mess of limbs, rigid and broken, down before me on our front lawn.